Hi, this is Paul. Welcome to the Things I Didn't Learn in School podcast. For those of you that are newer to these conversations, the podcasts are one of three things that Still Press puts out. There's also a weekly essay that comes out on Substack. You can sign up for either the free or the paid versions on my website, paulpodolsky.com. And there's also a book, Raising a Thief, and another one, Master Minion. And if you enjoy these conversations, I think that you will enjoy the books and the essays as well. And so with that, thanks for listening, and let's get into our conversation. My guest today is Andrew Weiss. So happy to have him back. Russia expert, bigwig at Carnegie, and now the author of this fantastic book, Accidental Czar, which is, if you've read the Mouse comic books, it sort of has that feel to it. It's a fascinating distillation of Putin's whole reign in an incredibly readable form. So I recommend it. So Andrew, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for the kind words, Paul. Great to be here.
I have lots of questions about the book, but before we jump in, why don't you just step back and say a little bit like, what the heck do you think is going on in Russia right now? I mean, this has moved so far out the realm of really what I could have imagined. It's almost like if I was reading a science fiction book in the summer of 1990, the first summer I was there, and somebody was relaying this type of picture, that's how distant it would have been from my consciousness. And now it's our day-to-day reality, you know, waking up and the latest missile volleys in and et cetera. So what are your thoughts?
No, it's a hard question to answer. I think we are well past the known parameters of our lifetimes. We never thought of Russia as abhorrent or as, operating in, there are plenty of things Russia was doing over the past 30 years that I'm sure you and I weren't happy about. But now Russia has, thoroughly put itself into the universe of, the world's biggest pariahs. And you see not just the Russian leadership, but you see Russian society embracing or at least accepting and being unbothered by the stuff you were just describing. You know, we have mass killing in Ukraine as a feature of what Russian forces do. We have a Russian government that traffics in complete, quasi-genocidal untruth, or actual genocidal untruth about what it's up to and why it's doing it in a country that, for the longest time has, been relatively friendly towards Russia on the whole. None of this makes sense. None of it is justifiable. And then, the big question mark, as you were saying, is like, well, what's actually happening over there? And I think short answer is we don't really have good insights anymore. Russia has become harder to get to, people like you or me. It's my job to study Russia, but I'm not traveling there. Information sources are really limited. There are a handful of Western correspondents who are still based there. There's social media and other types of information sources you can get access to, but you never really know how accurate or objective those information sources are. And then lastly is, I think at some point, there's a Russian colleague of mine at Carnegie, a former colleague who used to say, it's not as simple as it looks. It's a lot simpler. And I think that kind of sums up what we're dealing with is we have a authoritarian country, personalistic authoritarian country ruled by basically one guy and his inner circle. And they've embarked on this criminal war and they're able to bring along most of Russian society behind them. Not all of it by any stretch, but, we're talking about 70%+ passive or active support.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing I can think of that's similar to this, and of course you don't want to draw comparisons that are too tight because nothing is perfect and there's big differences, but it is reminiscent of, what I've read about of Germany, that you have, of course, countries implode all the time, but it's more shocking when a country has, again, there's big differences, but an intellectual sophistication and industrial sophistication, economic integration, et cetera. And then it literally just goes off the deep end. And, you know, we don't know, your book lays out, you know, he could live like Lee Kuan Yew for years. We could be dealing with this. And if you were to think about Germany, say, in 1933, 34 type of, maybe a little bit that type of sense.
Yeah. No, it's exactly the kind of thought process that that I've gone through over the past year, is thinking about what we learned during World War II about how German society, you know, was directly implicated by what its horrible government was doing. And, you know, you see indications every day from Russia that most people either choose to look away and choose to, you know, sort of check out, you know, the sort of normal people might want to just kind of not, the less they know, the better. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as you go down either in socioeconomic terms or in terms of level of education, you see people who are willing to believe big lies, or at least not actively question big lies. And then there is this loyalist segment, which is a big segment of Russian society that's heavily dependent on the state and that, you know, buys the framing. And the framing the Russian government has offered has been so contorted and so self-serving. You know, the idea that, you know, NATO was going to hit us, so it's better to hit them first before they hit Russia.
Right.
Or that, you know, there's a, you know, that you just use the suggestion that there's neo-Nazis running around Ukraine and you can justify anything. You know, these are laughable concepts that any normal tuned in person might reject, but there's something going on in Russia and Russian society that I think, you know, really we all have to focus on, which is why is it that 20% of that country is rah-rah, super enthusiastic about the war? There's a big kind of 60% in the middle that's probably either indifferent but accepting. And then you only have about 20% of the country that's actively opposed. And, you know, most of our lifetimes have been spent dealing with that 20%. Not all of it, but that is kind of heavily concentrated.
Totally.
Yeah, exactly. And that's still tens of millions of people.
Those are the people who would reach out to us.
Yeah. So it's not zero in terms of, you know, the level of, you know, our knowledge of the other segments of Russian society. I mean, you've had dealings with that 80% that's either down with the program or kind of stuck passively and complicitly engaged with the program.
Yeah, it's my daily. Yeah. It's my almost daily conversation with the mother-in-law. She gets that, you know, is a whole full-throated supporter. There's a similarity, I think, of it, just to push on the Germany thing a little bit more, is I think about the hyperinflation in Germany 21 to 23 and how that just shattered any sense of confidence in the system. It seemed to, there's some sort of deep, profound psychological change that underwent there. And I wonder, it's of course, we all saw it, but the impact of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I try to say to Americans, like, imagine coming into school and being like, well, George Washington was a war criminal and that whole Constitution thing was bullshit. It's kind of difficult to, and your book touches on the sum that there's sort of a clear national myth for the United States that's kind of universal. It appeals to, literally pulls people in from all over the world. Russia's lacking that a little bit. How much do you think that the economic, I mean, you can't, it's impossible. It's the land of sort of hypothetical political scientists to draw cause effect, but there is this, you and I were both sort of coming of age there during this chaos of the 1990s. And I remember thinking it was, and I was so immature then, but thinking it was almost funny how we were being on Red Square, I think in the summer of 92, and my brother was visiting. And I was like, you can't believe how corrupt this place is. And he was like, how corrupt? And I said, you could buy anything. And we were on Red Square, and they were cleaning Red Square with these huge trucks with water. And I said, I can buy that guy in the truck right there. And he said, he's cleaning Red Square. You can't buy that guy. I said, you want to watch? I said, I'll buy the guy in the truck. And so, God, I hope saying this on air, I'm not like arrested for violating some sort of financial thing. But so I walked over there. I waved. The guy stopped the truck. I walked up to him and I had a dollar in my pocket. And I said, a buck to drive me and my brother back to our apartment, which was a couple miles away from Red Square. And the guy was like, no problem. I jumped in it you know, lights still on, drove straight to my brother. I rolled down the window. I said, "Get in." And then we drove down there. My brother was like, "Unbelievable." And I said, "This place has nuclear weapons, man." Like, I thought it was kind of funny, but I didn't realize, it's still kind of funny, but I didn't realize at the time, maybe that's incredibly dangerous, that people can tolerate a certain rate of change in these national myths. They have to believe in something. And when you destroy this, maybe it lays the groundwork for something. I mean, the United States, maybe Black Americans have been through this, but for a significant chunk of the country, it's not even fathomable to go through that type of economic disruption that they went through and Germany went through. Does that have any, that resonate with you at all? Does it seem kind of harebrained? What are your thoughts?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Couple quick thoughts. So one of the key themes of the book is that let's talk about Putin and let's try to distinguish Putin and his cohort's view of what you just described and Joe Sixpack.
Yep.
And for someone like Putin, who had it pretty good, you know, he had a decent job, you know, he came from a working class family, got to go to a good school, and then had, you know, a 25 plus year career in the KGB. Mm-hmm. Everything you just described was the height of horribleness and humiliation, right? And it was Russia laid low on the international stage, reduced to having to, you know, borrow, beg, you know, support from the United States and our Western-led institutions like the IMF and the World Bank. And it was, you know, it was a real comeuppance. And everything that he had worked for or believed in was now, you know, tarnished and disregarded by society. But the thing that sort of animated him, and I think if you look at sort of what is it that drives him, it's this, you know, view that the strong state is necessary to keep Russia whole. Yep. And to lead a country and run a country as, you know, big geographic terms and as diverse in terms of its population. So that is to me, the guiding spirit of Putin's tenure. And there's this word in Russian, государственник, supporter of a strong state. And in that, you know, I sort of go into this in detail in the book, you know, it's let's make sure that the interests of a strong state prevail over everything else, the rule of law, the rights of the individual, et cetera, et cetera. And you can, I think, lump most everything he's done under that umbrella. Mm-hmm. The piece that is trickier is average people's experience of all the chaos.
Yep.
And then you have a run-up in average living standards and people's socioeconomic reality over the course of the first two decades of Putin's rule. It stagnates and plateaus, but you see a rapid set of gains that lift most of average Russians into a level of comfort or consumerism that they'd never seen in the previous 1,000 years. And what I think is the glue, and this comes back to the 60% that I was saying is kind of averting its glance or passive and dependent on the state in some way, is no one wants to go back to the Russia you described in the early 90s when everything had fallen apart. And they're willing to tolerate the status quo because they're fearful of that upheaval or, you know, calamity. And having lived through it in their lifetimes, they don't want to experience that again. It's trickier with young people who didn't have that experience. And Russia is a graying society. So that band, like, people love to sort of look at, wow, Russian young people, they don't support the war and they use the internet and they're, you know, more worldly, but that's a narrow segment of Russian society because people didn't have kids in the early 1990s. And so there's just a lot fewer young people in Russia than there would have been but for that huge economic collapse.
And it's also so odd to me watching what's going on that I would have assumed, also wrongly, that as Russia experienced that, of course, yes, out in the provinces, it wasn't nearly as much. I get all that. But still, just the vast modernization, so much financial investment to try to boost standards. And you could feel it. You know, the airplanes went from being terrifying to civilized. The roads got better. The supermarkets, even for basic people, had choices that were unfathomable to the Soviet Union. The idea that you'd want to retreat on that from some sort of bizarre imagined enemy from a distant land also I find so bizarre, but it's clearly very real. And people apparently willing, given the statistics you're citing, willing to sacrifice higher living standards for the belief in this kind of mystical truth.
Yeah. And then I also, you know, I don't want to engage in, you know, stereotyping and cultural essentialism, but it's important to remember that Russia is, you know, a country that has a very inhospitable climate and in which, you know, horrible things have happened to people in previous generations, whether, you know, it was the oppression of the Soviet system or the feudal system and serfdom. And it was a largely peasant society that rapidly urbanized in the early 20th century. And so people are only one or two generations removed from this more subsistence existence. And there's a narrow, you know, level that's the Russia that, you know, I engaged with throughout most of my life. That's the urbanized intelligentsia who, you know, were worldly and educated and different than what Russians always refer to in this semi-dismissive way, you know, narod, you know, meaning the people or the commoners. And, you know, the analogy that I still think is very powerful when I think about what explains this passivity is in there's a section in Richard Pipe's book, Russia Under the Old Regime, where he talks about how living in a society, you know, largely agrarian peasant society, which is what Russia predominantly was, where you never knew if you were going to make it through the winter every year and that you were really right on the edge of not surviving. The people in that society who came along with innovative proposals and would say, hey, why don't we rotate the crops and we'll get better yields? Like those people were not welcomed with open arms in a lot of traditional Russian society. That was, you know, a level of risk that most people weren't willing to take. And if you extrapolate that forward into the current moment, if someone says, you know, I'm knocking on your door and I'm, you know, I'm a supporter of Alexei Navalny or, you know, some other, you know, dissenting political voice, and I've got a plan that will help Russia be different and will, you know, overcome the hardships of the moment or will end the war in Ukraine, I can understand why most people slam the door in such a person's face, literally or metaphorically. You know, people are just not open to alternatives on a lot of levels. And in part, it's, you know, it's a country that hasn't had great options, right? And there wasn't always a great vision in the last 30 years of like, what will Russia be on the world stage? You know, the Putin view of that was frankly pretty limited. It was like, we'll be respected again, or these things that I don't think really mattered that much to average people. I don't think, you know, being influential on the world stage mattered as much to Joe Sixpack as it did to Vladimir Putin. But Vladimir Putin's the one whose vote really counted. And that's, and I mean, to come back to the book, I think that's really what, you know, we all have to remember is this is much more about Putin and about the views of a narrow group of implementers around him putting Russia on this course rather than Russia as a, you know, a mobilized society. Like what we see so far.
In a way, we don't even know, right? Because if you kill people for raising their voices, how can you really know what is on people's? It's very difficult to get. I mean, there's polling information, et cetera. But once you create that type of momentum, it's hard to know what's truly on Joe Sixpack's mind the way you could have like a wildly disruptive election in the West.
Yeah. Although, I mean, what's interesting is when we see attempts to mobilize Russian society right now, it's not working. And you have a kind of, you know, sharp contrast between the reaction to the war that began almost exactly a year ago on February 24th and the reaction to the annexation of Crimea, where I think there was a kind of, you know, outpouring of public enthusiasm, wrongheaded and horrible as it was. Like, you don't see that these days. You don't see on television, and we all get subjected to these, you know, horrible images from Russian state-controlled television of, like, you know, these horrible shout fests on talk shows and things like that, where it creates the impression that the average person surely is, you know, is loving it as much as these odious people on television are talking, you know, about killing Ukrainians and defeating America, but I think that's probably not the case.
So one of the things you said is corruption is the glue that holds everything together. And I think that that's probably true. It's also something I found almost all over the world. Regular people loathe corruption. It's one thing that unites people all over the world. So it's a paradox that it both holds things together and people hate it.
Yeah. I mean, the part of the problem with talking about corruption is it's one thing if you are subjected to petty interference in your daily life and you need to pay somebody off to get your kid a place in school or medical treatment, or you need, you know, a hospital bed for an elderly relative, right? And I think that stuff is infuriating. It's not the case necessarily, and I don't know if I have good data, I think this is just my impression, that people in the West feel like if only we had more investigative journalism and we could see inside the, you know, lifestyles of the rich and famous of the Russian government and their, you know, closely associated friends in the private sector or state-controlled business entities, average Russians would be so mad that they would storm the Bastille and they would bring this whole thing to a speedy conclusion. And I don't think that's quite right. I think what we've seen in the, you know, the endless amounts of exposés that are done on YouTube by the anti-corruption activist Alexei Navalny is Russians see it and they hate it. But on some level, they're like, yeah, it's Russia. It's always been the case that our leaders are a bunch of, you know, people showering themselves in ill-gotten wealth. Right. And we get stuck with the, you know, the rounding error. And I don't think that's necessarily going to inspire anybody to challenge the political order. I would be happy to be proven wrong. I'd be the happiest person in the planet to be told that, no, this will stimulate average Russians to throw off their chains and challenge the political regime that they're confronted by. But, you know, there is a, you know, political reality out there, which is Alexei Navalny has never polled very high. Right. And, you know, his poll and approval rating is something historically, even before, you know, there was sympathy for him after he was poisoned and the Russian government tried to assassinate him. But it was not like ever the case. I mean, I'd be happy if one of your listeners can find the data that he had support more than like 20% of the population. So there's something about acceptance. And one of the explanations I heard from a Russian colleague was Russians like viewing these videos in part just out of the titillation, like the sheer, like, yeah, he's the czar. I'd like to see what the czar's bedroom looks like. But it's not because I want to do him in.
To some degree, it's basically what you're describing is a place that's not fully modern.
Yeah.
And that's what you're, and societies are, I've had this for a number of experts from China that you know, China's an ancient place. It evolves very slowly. Culture evolves slowly. And so even though you could have things that look modern, the underlying system only, it's a very, very glacial process, and it may be changing, but it's fits and starts, and it's not over sort of a human lifespan.
Could I ask you a question about this? Just to turn the tables a bit, which is, you and I both worked in the financial services industry at various stages of our career. We both know Russia well. I personally grew up in Beverly Hills, so I have some awareness of, you know, ultra affluence. But what I saw in Russia over the course of my time was always kind of more shocking than anything I had seen either in the hedge fund world or in Beverly Hills in terms of just the over the top level of affluence and how many levels down it went. Whereas like in the US, you'd need to go see the owner of the hedge fund or the, you know, the top partners to see that. Yeah. But in Russia, it's like it goes down to, you know, literally there's this funny case in one of the Navalny, I think, investigations where it's like the traffic inspector in some private, I mean, in some like provincial Russian city, he had a gold toilet. You know, I mean, there are these things where it's just, it's remarkable how many layers down in the society the rot goes.
So what's the question?
So the question is, does that seem weird? Was that notable to you as well?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I always thought the difference was of course, there's fraud in the United States too. There's fraud in all places. But the difference was is that you had to earn it in the United States, and that it was hyper-competitive. I mean, to become a top hedge fund boss, it's not like you can pay off some minister and find out what the CPI report is going to be. You have to spend hours going through the data and guessing, getting your teeth kicked in with trades and have natural talent and all that type of thing. And at the end of that, you, if you're exceptional, you begin to get these untold, you know, you begin to become fantastically wealthy, but they remember how hard it was to create, and they know how quickly it can disappear. And so there's a totally different attitude towards wealth when it's created like that. Whereas if you steal it, I think it, as long as you're stealing it, it seems pretty easy. And then there's the whole peasant thing in there, that there too, lack of private property and what that mentality is and stuff. So yeah, I always found the Russia thing extraordinary. The similar place I saw it was in the Gulf states. You could see some of that same type and, you know, similar economy. Talk about Putin early on. You have this quote from Strom Talbot. He has the manner of a disciplined, efficient, self-facing executive assistant. And then he turns out to be, you know, really, really cold-blooded. So do you think that this is a case where the role is so massive and so impossible to imagine being a czar and what it does to you that he became changed? Or is this the case more of like a psychopath who is incredibly disciplined in hedging his bets and has all this childhood trauma, and then when he finally can exert power, he becomes just, you know, uncontainable?
Yeah, it's probably both, but I lean towards the former explanation. And maybe, and part of why I wrote the book in the first place is the world has been inundated with assessments of Vladimir Putin that I found were overly generous about his innate capabilities, about the significance of things like his KGB background and the people he surrounded himself with. I always felt, and I'm passing judgment here, which is probably a little unwarranted, that there was just an abundance of mediocrity, and that the team that he led and that he himself, you know, these were not people who were had good runs in the Soviet intelligence apparatus. These were people who operated on specialties that were not where you put the best of the best. They were people that were more in the knuckle dragger category, like counterintelligence, which sort of has some aura for people in the West, was like, you know, basically looking at, you know, threats from within, or, you know, Western intelligence operations against Russia. Like, that was just not the fun or high flyer route. This was a place where you put the people who didn't do very well. And that was my impression of Putin and his career. He was someone who had not had a successful career and had not been treated to the spoils that the Soviet system would have provided to someone. That's why he ended up in Dresden, this tiny villa with six operatives in East Germany. It was not where he put the high flyers. And so what I heard, and I think this is true, is that the person Putin was 25 years ago, when he was first arriving in Moscow and had to be kind of a hard worker, and it's sort of like the analogy you described about the hedge fund person who has to kind of get going, he distinguished himself through dedication and hard work and a level of obsequiousness and not being someone who threw his weight around. The Western mythology about him is like, oh, he was deep selected and the KGB had this grand plan for taking Russia back, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't buy that. But what I do think happened, and there's a colleague who I really had just tremendous respect for, who unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago, who had lived in Russia for a long time. And I gave him the exact question that you presented. And he said, well, but look, if you've been treated that way as like the pachan, there's a good word in Russian, pachan, which basically means like the boss of bosses or the head of the criminal gang, you start to behave differently. And, you know, at some point that role, Putin has sort of grown into it. And because he's a pretty cunning character and very nimble, he's always sort of made this thing work. And his expectations from his subordinates or from the outside world are pretty cynical and pretty jaundiced. And so he's not like, you know, an American CEO who was expecting that they were going to make the best product and have the greatest, you know, acumen. It was just always going to be Russia, and there would be these kind of like ho-hum outcomes. And I think the war in Ukraine is probably the most interesting case where, you know, Putin has never really had super high expectations. And, you know, but I think even he has to be just amazingly disappointed by how badly this has gone in terms of military success on the battlefield. You know, they were really cocky. They really walked in and thought they were going to, you know, demolish Ukraine, and the Ukrainians have kicked them, as you know, to use your term, completely in the teeth. And so there's a question of, like, is he out of touch? Has he lost it? You know, what was it that made Putin so successful in the first 20 years that, you know, is not there anymore? And how do we explain the gap in his professional performance?
Do you have any answer to that?
Well, I think the easy one is that, you know, he had the worst work from home pandemic experience of any major leader, and marinated himself in a lot of bad policy advice and fake history, and, you know, was not tested, or his assumptions weren't tested during that period because he was largely in isolation. And so, you know, everyone sees the pictures of Putin sitting at the end of that long table with his subordinates. Over time, he's gotten pretty remote from day-to-day governance in the run-up to the war. Now he's overly involved, you know, in terms of, you know, with the map metaphorically spread out in front of him on the Kremlin conference table, pointing at, you know, targets to hit. But for the previous several years, he's been kind of checked out and was not doing very much. And I think even when he decided to leave the presidency because he was term limited out in 2008, I think part of that was because he just found a lot of parts of the job pretty boring. And, you know, the ceremonial and representational parts of the job he never enjoyed. And that was in part why he handed things off to Dmitry Medvedev in 2008. It's like he was done with that part of the job. And then when Medvedev messed things up, he felt sort of forced to come back in 2011, 2012. I don't think this was someone who was relishing the chance to have to, you know, deal with foreign leaders again and, you know, deal with all these endless problems. Because being leader of Russia means being besieged with people who want something from you, or, you know, like, it's just constant people bitching and moaning and seeking advantage over the people they're at odds with inside the system. And he's the guy who kind of sits at the top of that, right?
Tough place to rule, very, very weak civil society. And so it's in some ways, it's a cage. I tracked a lot of the funding of U.S. various different opposition groups. I hadn't honed in as much probably as I should have on the Serbian thing, so I thought that was interesting. And particularly this professor you highlighted, I never frankly heard of him before, Gene Sharp. I Googled him. That was pretty interesting to me. So it's basically, this is also something that I can say full respect for people who work in these things, but I'd say like the cutting edge of the U.S. intellectual and financial elite is not working at USAID in Belgrade. But evidently, it was this effort was enough to scare the hell out of the Kremlin.
Yeah. So we all, and I fully will stipulate that, you know, there is a side to Putin and his cohort that's all about, you know, imperialism and wanting to dominate the surrounding countries that emerged from the Soviet Union because right. They're part of Russia's birthright or some historical inheritance. And then Yeltsin overnight got rid of it and they've wanted parts of it back, or at least want to be top dog in some parts of it. And Ukraine was, you know, special, and they just always, you know, were fixated on the status of Ukraine and wanting it to be subservient. But the thing that you're alluding to, which I don't think people factor in enough, is that in 2000, early in Putin's time, there was a showdown on the streets of major cities in Belgrade between a group of very grumpy average people and an avant-garde of students. And the students said, "You've stolen an election. You clearly were going to be voted out." And they told the then leader of what was called Yugoslavia, it was before Serbia and Montenegro divorced, that you need to step down. And Slobodan Milosevic, who'd led Yugoslavia during the Balkans Wars, refused. And there was this showdown. And it was a very scary moment. I remember being at the White House, and people were really worried about what would happen and whether the Serbian security services would open fire on the students and the other protesters. And it was very dicey. And one of the fascinating things I found when I was doing the research for the book is that President Clinton has publicly disclosed that there was a covert action finding that the U.S. government had utilized as a way of helping stimulate some of this protest and helping organize it. And the student protesters had taken classes from this ideologue who lived in a pretty rarefied world of like small time, you know, sort of like theorizing about how you dislodge authoritarian governments. And this guy had sort of tried to study this in his career. He wasn't really an academic. I mean, he kind of had this like one-man institute in Boston, and he was just this very courageous, intellectually interesting guy. And his acolytes helped lead some of the initial wave of what the Soviets and the Russians and the Chinese call color revolutions. So the first one was in Serbia, and then there were more in places like Kyrgyzstan and Georgia, and then most vividly in Ukraine in the Orange Revolution in 2004. And it was the fear of these things happening that I think has really driven Putin round the bend. And it's not just the fact that he screwed things up repeatedly in Russia's dealings with neighboring countries, especially Ukraine, but that it's that he believes and the people around him believe that the U.S. is constantly going around the world organizing these kinds of popular uprisings as a way of getting rid of governments we don't like. And it just fuels a level of kind of paranoia and obsession about their own regime's preservation, as well as the possibility that the U.S. is going to throw Russia, you know, out on its ear from places that it feels rightfully it should have sway over. And so just to bring this back to the present, that's a big part of what happened in 2014 with the start of the war, was the sense that the U.S. had orchestrated another revolution in Ukraine, and then this was going to disadvantage Russia. And that's why Russia needed to swoop in and, you know, seize Crimea and start the war in eastern Ukraine. And that's why we've been on this horrible path ever since.
So in those meetings where you were in the White House and otherwise, did the Russians, Putin or other, just directly confront you guys about that? And what was the United States response?
I don't recall that happening, but what I do recall was that there was plenty of available information out there on display showing and there were articles in the press explaining the way the United States had helped train the students, the role of Gene Sharp as being the person who'd written this like guidebook on how to, you know, jujitsu, in his terms, authoritarian regimes to their knees, and that how to sort of crack things open. And that if you could get, you know, people to come off the sidelines, that would be enough. And that, you know, there's this great line, I think, in the book where Gene Sharp says, regimes are never as strong as they appear, and people are never as weak as they appear. And you just need to figure out the way, the sort of pincer that exposes that, and you can crack open an authoritarian government. That's not true in China. It's not true in Russia. So it doesn't work everywhere.
And then there's another thing that's going on in the background of this, which is there's a enormous economic shift that's unfolding in the West, which, by the way, causes huge amounts of volatility here. It's caused two stock market bubbles and companies to fail, millions of people to get hired, millions of people to get fired. But through the Russian prism, they look at these changes. You said this you have this thing from highly placed managers of Google and some sign being held up, the Egyptians saying, we want the internet, that in the Russian, or at least in the Kremlin mind, this idea of Serbian color revolutions and disruptive technology, they kind of get melded, it feels like, or there's a sort of porous boundary between them. When the reality is, okay, you know, you might have had people over there trying to, you've confirmed in Serbia that you did, but the idea that Google is thinking that free internet searches are going to disrupt the Kremlin is like low on their list of priorities. But this type of economic change, the information we've lived through, is highly threatening to this type of this form of rule.
Yeah, but it's not as black and white, maybe, as you make it out to be. So just to take the China versus Russia comparison.
Yep.
In China, you can't do a Google search. And they built their internet architecture to force onshore users to not be dependent on Western platforms. And there are these domestic companies like Baidu. And those are well orchestrated in terms of the kind of content they can and can't return for a simple web search. In Russia, They didn't do any of that. And mm-hmm. they endorsed and embraced the internet as a way to bring efficiency to the Russian economy and a level of consumer satisfaction to average people. And content delivery and other things was largely unimpeded up till the beginning of the war. And now, you know, they had this big shock to the system where the government's like, holy smokes, we don't want people to be able to Google Ukraine war. But they realize there's some problems. One is that the people that they really depend on to stay in power aren't necessarily using the internet that much. They're watching TV. And so if you can kind of keep the, you know, they, for the most of the preceding 20 odd years, they were happy to have that split screen of free internet, state control of major media. And you could keep the niche smaller stuff and you could tolerate it. And it was fine. After February 24th, there was this apparent judgment like, no, we can't even tolerate that niche stuff anymore. And we can't tolerate the major Western owned social media platforms, you know, being active here. So they tried to push them out. But then they came up against the bizarreness of contemporary Russia, which is if you remove access to YouTube, average people are going to be really freaked out because they're relying on YouTube for cat videos or whatever else, you know, they consume. And they didn't have the courage of their own convictions. So right now we're in this bizarre world where average Russians can watch whatever the heck they want on YouTube. And they do that in droves. And they're not even really blocking a lot of the other internet tools that you and I would consider part of our normal diet. And average Russians, you know, have managed to master VPN technology, like they're just doing the same stuff they were doing. They may not be posting on those websites the way they used to because they don't want to call attention to themselves and get scrutiny. But it's just a very different internet dynamic than you have in more authoritarian countries.
Right. Totally agree. True, they have not done nearly the steps the Chinese have done, but they look at these companies as another form of, I guess, imperialism isn't right, exactly the right word, but sort of potential threat. Or you think not strong enough to forbid it?
I mean, I think it's tricky and it all depends. I mean, that's a wishy-washy, think-tanky way to answer stuff. But like, you know, so for example, for a long time, they were really worried about tools that would allow people to communicate and convene a protest and sort of horizontal Telegram communication. And all that, so they went after, there was an early series of protests. I can't remember what year it was probably like 2020 or no, it was before the pandemic. So 2018. Where truck drivers were mad about corrupt road toll system. And they were using a app that enabled sort of walkie-talkie horizontal communication. And they would coordinate where the trucks would go to block the roads to show how unhappy they were. And that app was banned really quickly. But the Russian government, you know, knows pretty well that the social media platforms that people are using are either things like YouTube, which isn't really social, but that is a, you know, entertainment resource. The things that are being utilized that have massive amounts of data and data on Russian nationals, I don't think they know what to do about. And I think the agenda that they have is societal control and bolstering the regime so that, you know, and they have a dispensation to just go after the people they hate. And so if they know you as an activist and they see you're active on social media, they're going to zap you and, you know, try to use your internet activity as a basis for persecution or prosecution. And out in the provinces, there are these local police chiefs who have a quota of, you know, we need to arrest 100 people a month. And they go around and they see who in the town is posting, you know, memes that are unacceptable. And they zap those people. At the senior-most levels of the government, a long way of answering your question, Paul, is a fear that Google or Facebook or any of the major media platforms are in cahoots with the Western intelligence and, you know, sort of dark deep state. And those people are, you know, have a bad agenda. But they've never figured out, well, how would you run a country that doesn't use Google search anymore? And how the hell are you going to run a country that doesn't allow enterprise software to operate? And now the Russians have, you know, opened up this massive can of worms for themselves of saying, like, state companies have to get rid of Oracle and they have to get rid of, you know, these data software platforms that, you know, now need to be somehow magically replaced by a Russian analog. And I mean, it's not going to surprise anybody that the Russian analogs are horrible for the most part and are going to take years to possibly be sufficient to run industrial control systems or, you know, data processing to have a country that, you know, is of Russia's scale. It's just going to be incredibly painful to reverse engineer out that stuff from the Russian system.
Right. And that seems to be the biggest strategic flaw seems to be what I look at. Both Putin and the people close to him, I would say, is a very poor understanding of how modern economics works, which I think is to some degree exacerbated by the fact that they took power during an oil boom and they were flush, et cetera. But I found this speaking with people there is that the ability to understand what it would actually require to raise Russia's productivity and build out the capital markets, like everything they're doing now, it is so, so deeply against it I think it'll lop, you know, a couple of percentage a year. I mean, their own statistics say the economy's contracting, but if potential GDP was, you know, call it 1.5% a year, 2% a year, I think that it has a hugely devastating contractionary effect on what their potential GDP would be because the whole technology thing is now off the table.
Yeah, and, but they've been economically literate for a long time, right?
Right.
They were allergic to debt for reasons having to do with Putin's own, memory of what it was like to have, you know, the country take on so much in the run up to the 1998 financial crisis that then popped and they were really desperate and they had to run to the West to get a bailout. They were like, never again. But, you know, as a result, they've put themselves on this path of underdevelopment, intense corruption, distribution based as opposed to a market based economy, and then heavy dependence on the handful of exports that Russia's going to be valuable in, right? And those tend to be in the raw materials sector. And the things they're exporting now are like brain power, right? The most talented people, the people who feel their skills are going to get them hired outside of Russia are, for the most part, eager to leave. Like, they don't want to live in a country like this. And so it just leaves you with this huge adverse selection problem of, like, who's going to be left? Like, who's going to want to work at a Russian tech firm? Who's going to want to be, you know, in a state company that, you know, is badly run, heavily corrupt.
Who's going to want to found a company there, a new company there?
Yeah.
Talk about, if you would, whataboutism. You mentioned this on page 184, which I thought was interesting, how the Snowden thing played into whataboutism. So a core part, I would say, of the propaganda and of the biggest state supporters I've known in Russia is just using this again and again. In other words, if you point out, well, you know, Bucha looks like a war crime, they go, well, what about? And then there's... Poof, I remember Soviet propaganda just being more outlandish. This is like a different form of that. And you talk about it with the Snowden thing that sort of gave them lots of fuel, like who was more wicked, the West or Russia? It could be up for grabs.
Yeah. I mean, the Russian propaganda apparatus has been reborn over the past 10 plus years. And it's a business. And there are people who get huge amounts of state funding and who are clever and who, you know, benefit from the attention they get from the regime because they're doing a good job. Like, they tout the, you know, the value of what Putin's done for Russia. And, you know, they can say, look, your public is more subservient after people are brainwashed by our propaganda. And I think that's the primary purpose of what they do. And then globally, they've been up to a point relatively successful at discrediting the United States. We've done things ourselves that have hurt America standing in the world. And when those things have happened, the Russians have just exploited that for their own purposes. Like, we didn't invade Iraq because, you know, Russian propaganda told us to do it. You know, we did it for foolhardy reasons, right? But what the state did is it made people believe that, and it's amazing to me still when you bring up Snowden, that like no one is wondering, like, is that messed up that Edward Snowden is a Russian citizen now?
Campaigner for truth.
And goes out all the time on social media to poke the United States and, you know, use the Kremlin's messages. And people still sort of treat Edward Snowden as if he's an advocate for good things. I mean, there's something about it that to me is just so contemptible. And wrongheaded. But when the original story broke in the early, I think it was like 2013 timeframe about what Snowden had stolen from his job as a contractor, it, you know, was a great way for the Russians to just simply say, oh, the U.S. is the, you know, is a hypocrite and, you know, it engages in these, you know, legal activities and, you know, you're no different than we are. And, you know, I think that that is a very satisfying position for members of the Russian elite to kind of say America doesn't live up to the standards and the, you know, the values that it professes to support. And I, you know, I believe in those values and I do think that the United States is a, you know, is not the character, the cartoon character that the Russian government makes us out to be. And I think their indictment doesn't hold water. The challenge is that in the world we live in, where media is so fractionated and people are all easily just, you know, led down different pathways, a lot of what the Russians have been purveying sells. And there's, you know, there's intense anti-elite sentiment, you know, all over the world. There's sense of anger about inequality. There's, you know, there's frustration about the decline in living standards, whatever it is. And, you know, we saw this with Donald Trump, like those messages resonate with people. And, you know, Russia didn't invent them, but it certainly knows how to capitalize on them. And we, if all we do is sit around and say, it's making me mad that you're doing this, we're losing. And if all we're doing is complaining about Russian propaganda, we're losing. And we need to be smarter and better and not, you know, we also need to think about our resources and where we can be effective in making a dent, you know, in this, you know, challenge. And then last thing I'd say is there's a scale problem, which is a lot of these messages are being pumped out by the most popular television network in the United States. And they have a much bigger reach, Fox News, than the Russian government does. And they have a much bigger megaphone. And the messages they're pumping out about Ukraine or any other issue, which align really closely with the Kremlin's talking points, like that's a real challenge for us as a society. But we haven't really found a way to deal with that.
And do you have any thoughts about that?
It's not my bag, but I do believe that it is, you know, it's really shocking that every night on, you know, Tucker Carlson's show, he is saying that, you know, Ukraine's a waste of time, that, you know, Ukraine's a bad country, that your tax dollars are being wasted, and that, you know, we should trust what Vladimir Putin wants to be okay. And, you know, it's still just, you know, shocking to me that that stuff is so prevalent. It's probably the case that, and I'm not an expert on the United States, that, you know, we will see those chickens come home to roost over the course of the next 2 years, because average people are just not going to be as supportive of the, you know, effort to support Ukraine as they were at the beginning of the war. And the, you know, Americans are notoriously, you know, ADD in how we look at the world, and like something else will, you know, compete for attention that wasn't the case over the past year. And I think that's, you know, driving some of the sense of urgency about what's going to happen over the coming year in Ukraine. It's just fear that, you know, is this, you know, war of attrition something that favors Russia more than it favors Ukraine?
It is that your fear as well?
Yeah, definitely. And the mood in Congress and the mood in, you know, the general public reflects that. Like, you've seen significant erosion in terms of people who were identified as members of one political party, the Republican Party, being less open to providing certain things to Ukraine. And that support was high at the very beginning, and it's now steadily eroding. And I think part of what accelerates it is the effect of things like Fox News, much more than Russian propaganda.
And have you, as anybody from Carnegie, engaged with Fox News at all, that conversation? Like why the hell, what's motivating? I mean, obviously their motivation is sell advertising in itself. So
yeah, I do appear on Fox News. Like, I'm not, you know, reluctant to do that. I think it's more just a question of there is just a big split in our country, and we're a polarized state these days. And that's just something, now that it's set in train, is going to take years, you know, if not decades, to unwind. You know, there's no magic overnight cure for polarization on the scale of what we're experiencing here.
I haven't looked recently, but when the debates were getting quite intense about McCarthy, I saw that a lot of the defense contractor stocks got whacked. And my thought was, is that what people are now discounting, that there'll be less support, less money? Last two questions that we end each interview with, if you want to ask me anything. Question number one is, how worried are you about nukes?
So over the summer, the Ukrainians launched a counteroffensive and they had really rapid success that has now petered out and we're back into more of a war of attrition. But the Russian government continues to believe that there is a magical ability based on, you know, whatever Joe Biden says to turn the level of violence up or down, and that the Ukrainians are just, you know, beholden to the United States to such an extent that the U.S. could tell the Ukrainians to knock it off. And I think a lot of the messaging the Russian government engaged in about nuclear scenarios was intended to make the United States try to push this mythical button on Joe Biden's desk to tell the Ukrainians to cool it. The risks of nuclear weapons being used in the war are pretty low. They're not zero. They're not absolutely zero. And I think that's why policymakers have to take it seriously. The challenge is that I don't think any Russian government will be comfortable with the notion of being run out of power. And I think that's why people are so, you know, just there's just a deep, you know, inherent uncomfortableness about, like, what kind of crazy thing would Vladimir Putin do if he felt it was, the option was end up in The Hague on trial for crimes against humanity or using a nuclear weapon. And if the debate ends up where those are the two choices he's facing, what will he do? And I think that's really a worrisome outcome. I don't think we're likely to get to that dilemma as a result of what's happening on the battlefield. I just don't think it's you know, likely the Ukrainians can cause Putin, you know, to fall from power, or for the Western governments to arrest Putin for what he's, the criminal activity he's carrying on in Ukraine right now. But I think that's the construct to keep in mind.
And do you see any potential off-ramp? I mean, I haven't seen a single word from any Russian official saying, well, we could just stop bombing.
Yeah. No, I think this is the part that's so worrisome, is that can the Ukrainians sustain a war that's this punishing on a, you know, somewhat open-ended basis that goes on for several years? And it's not clear they're comfortable with that prospect, I think, because they're, you know, we don't know a lot about their casualties, but, you know, their economy's been devastated. They're, you know, every day it's their best and the brightest who are on the battlefield, who are being, you know, being the victims of Russia's criminal war. On the Russian side, it's, you know, like prison populations that are being dumped into the battlefield. And in this war of attrition, Russia doesn't really care. Like, if a bunch of convicts get killed on the battlefield, no big deal. And so the, you know, the famous calculation of Russian leaders when they faced Napoleon, when they faced Hitler, was, you know, we've got this infinite capacity for pain, and Ukraine doesn't have infinite capacity for pain. But there's no, you know, this idea that the West can somehow foster a diplomatic conversation or kind of, you know, tell Ukraine to, you know, give Russia presence and then expect that Russia won't, you know, start the war again after it's had a chance to regroup and rebuild its forces. Like, you would never want to be the Western leader making that kind of recommendation to the Ukrainians.
Right. So it just seems it's a small percentage of Western, of NATO GDP, assuming there's political will, to keep paying to funnel weapons over there. $40 billion for us is different than $40 billion for Russia. So there's open-ended financial support, effectively. But the Russians are just willing to just continue going. And they need that. The collapse of the regime is basically what the goal is there, which is a pretty bloodthirsty goal. And they'll maintain it as long as Putin is alive, which could be many years.
Yeah. Now, one of my colleagues has a great line, which is that Putin is going to keep trying to do this until he dies, or he's going to die trying.
Yeah. That sounds like a rapper. Any questions for me, Andrew?
This has been great. I'm just sort of curious what's going on with your mother-in-law. That's probably the one I'm most curious about.
Unchanged. So she's very adamant in her support. Her older sister, she's long-lived. Her older sister lives in Vinnytsia, which is, I think it's like an hour outside of Kiev, and was bombed by Russian troops. And the older sister's husband was a former Soviet officer. So effectively, she's getting bombed by the offspring of her husband's leadership. And they're not on speaking terms anymore. The mother-in-law called up the sister, and the sister said, Maria, they're bombing us. And my mother-in-law said, as well they should.
Oh, that is so sad.
Yeah, and so this type of thing is happening in families all over. So my mother-in-law is completely brainwashed, and even just have the smallest conversations with her, you can get nowhere. So right after the most recent bombing of the apartment building where those women and children were killed, we spoke with her the next day. And I said, okay, you know, Maria, what are you and your girlfriends talking about in Moscow? And she said, we mostly talk about the war. And I said, okay, well, could you ask them a question the next time you're with them? And I said, do they think it's good for Russians to kill Ukrainian women and children? And she just blew up and began screaming at me. For some reason, I think this extends her life. I know this is not what you're supposed to do with old people, but she said, it is all NATO. No, no, no. I said, that's not the question I'm asking. It's like a microcosm of this whole conversation. I'm asking that Russian soldiers came into work, pressed buttons, and those buttons launched things, and then it killed people. They were alive before the buttons were pressed. Afterwards, they pressed them. Now they're dead. That specific action, do you think that that is a good thing for Russia to be doing? And we just could not even settle the conversation, and we tried every which way, and it was just screaming about how bad America is, and they're out to get Russia and stuff like that. So that's a barometer into that 60-70%, you know, she'll trust the government much more than she'll trust us or any objective facts. Or she has internet at her place. She can get BBC Russia. So she could read the news if she wanted to your point, and she doesn't want to.
Yeah, that's horrible. And very typical.
Very typical.
Yeah.
And that's not a party you can negotiate with, unfortunately. Yeah. And so yeah. You think that there's room for reasonableness, but in something like that, I think that maybe you're at one of these briefings too. There's some briefing I was at where the Ukrainian, who was it? It was Poroshenko was doing the rounds. And they said, you know, what is the best form of diplomacy for Ukraine? And he said the best form of diplomacy is our military. And I think that it's a concept that's very difficult for a certain ilk of Americans to understand.
Mm-hmm.
But it's basically, it's like a fight in an alleyway.
Yeah.
And you're going to get killed if you're weak.
Yeah. No, I 100% agree. And I don't recall, I'd have to go back and check, but during the Balkans Wars, I don't recall average Americans saying, we need to push the Bosnian Muslims to sit down with the Serbs and work things out.
Yeah.
And this is very similar. I mean, the Ukrainians fear that they're going to be wiped out and killed in their bedrooms, right? Like that's the stakes.
Yeah, it is very similar. And it's also very similar that, I mean, that's one of the reasons I took that trip to Serbia over the summer, because there's still a large chunk of that population that I would say that is, of course, not everybody, can't paint them all, but there's, you know, you could see all around downtown Belgrade this summer, you know, Ratko Mladenić is a hero, spray painted everywhere. And the only explanation I can come for that is that sometimes people think in terms of tribalism, and it hijacks any form of rationality, even though he's a convicted war criminal. That's there. And you'd think if Belgrade were trying to develop and be part of the European Union or whatever, which they espouse to have some interest in, that you'd want to get rid of all that stuff. But it's there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's a fun part. I mean, there's a passage in the book where this Russian sociologist talks about how hard it is to define Russianness, and like what makes Russia Russia isn't something that rolls off the tongue in most average people's heads. You know, it's not like life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness or the, you know, things that sort of make America America. But being anti is a very easy way for Russians to define their identity, and that you know, transposes onto the current moment, you know, anti-fascism or anti-American, you know, anti-Ukrainian.
And I think the essence of it is that it's anti-modernity.
Yeah.
And that's the strange thing, because modernity brings wealth and they crave wealth, they enjoy wealth, but the core of what they're doing is anti-modernity. And I just don't think that, like you said, those feudal traditions are still very, very strong there. And that's a strange feature of our existence, this acute modernism.
Yeah, totally agree.
So writing this book, Andrew,
yeah.
What is the biggest thing you didn't learn in school that you learned when you were writing this book?
I had this image that writing a graphic novel would be on some level easier than writing a traditional scholarly style book, because it would have fewer words. I'd have a collaborator who was a great artist named Brian Box Brown, and that stuff would just kind of go quick. And what I learned is actually writing a graphic novel is the slowest book you can write on the planet because it requires unbelievable levels of care and scrutiny of every panel of art, of all the aspects of the narrative. And I mean, it's like, I assume you're like me, you grew up reading comic books or cartoons, you know, comic strips in the newspaper. And so this, at least the prevalence of comics as an art form is misleading when it comes to the speed and the way a graphic novel is actually produced. The timeline between submission of the manuscript to release was on the order of 3 years.
Wow.
Really long timeline.
Andrew, thanks so much for coming on Things I Didn't Learn at School. I look forward to seeing what you're going to write next.
Thank you, Paul. Really great conversation. Thank you again.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. We're genuinely touched by all the support. If you want to see more of this type of content, sign up to my Substack on paulpodolsky.com and become a paid subscriber. That helps support the team. You could also submit a review to Apple Podcasts, which draws other listeners to this. If you have any questions, you can email me, paul@paulpodolsky.com, and follow me on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. Thanks so much. Today's podcast was produced and edited by Dave Manahan.